Yeah, so thank you for this nice introduction, the invitation. Today we heard some excellent high-level expert talks, and I want to complement that with a very low-level perspective of a researcher working at a university, and especially from the perspective of early career researchers and what kind of incentive structure works on them every day. I want to talk about two bubbles today, and the first bubble is our conference, or maybe the larger open science movement. It's admittedly the smaller bubbles of both. And to be honest, I think it's a great bubble. We all agree that openness and research transparency is an essential criterion of science, and it's so important that we even could skip the prefix open and just talk about science, which is open by definition. And in the last years, we have come to a broad consensus that spans funders, researchers, and policymakers that open science should be the way to go for the future. So we have heard today about the European Union, that they really embrace open science. Just some examples, German Research Foundation says that publicly funded research data belongs to the public, in principle, at least. And recently, the G7 science ministers issued a statement that we should recognize open science practices during the evaluation of funding proposals and outcomes, reward open science activities in career advancement. Also, researchers, as researchers, we have deeply internalized the norms of science. Here we have the four norms from Merton. Two of these norms are deeply tied to open science. So one of them is communality, that the findings of science belong to everyone, they are not private property. And the second norm is called organized skepticism, which means that all ideas must be tested and are subject to rigorous, structured community scrutiny. These norms also have counter norms, which is the opposite. They are called secrecy, which is hiding procedures, materials, and results. Well, that's the opposite of open science. And the counter norm of organized skepticism would be organized dogmatism, which is that all findings are not challenged, no independent verification takes place. And if we ask researchers whether they endorse the norms, or rather the counter norms of science, we find in a survey of more than 3,000 researchers from different disciplines that mid-career and early career researchers, mostly all of them subscribe to the norms of science, of openness and transparency. So it's 80 to 90% of them. So I think this is a wonderful world, a wonderful bubble we have achieved. And I can conclude based on that, that we reached a mutual trust relationship between researchers, funders, economy, and society. And this is all for societal benefit, the well-being, and for a competitive position in a globalized world. And I wish that I could stop here and we could go to the conference dinner. But before we do that, I'd like to take a look into the second bubble, which I would call everybody else in academia. And these are quite a lot of people. Let's go back to the norms of science. Well, subscription to a norm does not imply behavior according to that norm. So if we asked researchers, well, do you behave like that in your daily life? Well, the rates already dropped to around 60%. Well, of course, I behave like that. But if I ask, how do your peers behave? So if you look to the right and left of you, how do they act in their daily life? Well, they rather act according to the counter norms, which is secrecy, organized dogmatism, and so on. What does this lead if we hide our results and so on? Well, this is eroding trust in science. And in this large survey of scientists, 90% of us say, yes, we have a reproducibility crisis. And this has also reached the public interest. Now coming to the central topic of the conference, open data, data sharing, fair data. This is a survey or the attempt to get data sets. Well, this is within psychology. You heard I'm a psychologist, so some of these research results are within our discipline. Here, this is a survey where 100% of authors signed that they would share their data upon request. Now we had a nasty guy who actually requested the data. And what was the return rate? After several months and dozens of emails resending to the original researchers, well, the rate was 27% of actual data sharing. In a later study, it was 38%. So this simply does not work. And it's not always that they do not want to share it. Well, we have the bus factor. What happens if I get under the bus today? Nobody would be able to share my data. We have had cases of selective access, that researchers share the data happily with friendly collaborators, but not with my contrahents and not with critical researchers. So that means data set providers should not be in charge for the access to regulate the access to the data. We need it should be either fully open or we need independent stewards which grant the access based on pre-specified rules. So based on that, I would conclude sharing upon request simply is dead. We know it does not work. So why are researchers not sharing the data against their stated values? So their values would say, yes, sharing is important, but why do they not do it? Well, it's very easy. We are rewarding quantity and not quality. This is a survey among 1,400 psychology researchers. And we have seen the pie chart of the 662 professors. Around two-thirds of these professors answered this survey. So this is a good database for the state of our field about what are the relevant criteria in hiring committees for a professorship position. Now, we could make a little guessing game. What is the most important criterion for getting a professorship position? What would you say? Well, it's very easy. It's the number of the peer-reviewed publications. So I guess nobody's really surprised. The second rank is the fit of the research profile to the hiring department. Then comes the quality of the research talk. And then we have number of publications, volume of third-party funding, and number of first authorships. And this means that especially early career researchers are really stuck. I often make workshops on open science, and sometimes we do an anonymous FAQ session. So the participants hand in anonymously questions that they have about open science. And it's good to do it anonymously because then you get the unfiltered feelings and sentiments of these researchers. And these are original quotes. For example, what would be a good balance between open science and having a career in academia? Being open, in my humble opinion, is a competitive disadvantage. Can you only afford open science when you are tenured? That's another one. Why should I share my hard-won data with my rivals that presumably compete with me for the next postdoc position? Or that one. My contract is limited to 2 years. 1.5 already have passed. Although it would be nice to publish the data, I have no time to do it. I rather have to churn out another publication. So at least in their feelings, there's a contradiction between doing good research and having a career in science. And this is a very unfortunate situation, especially for the early career researchers. Yeah, we have seen that already. If you scroll down the list where we have some quality indicators, we find at position 17 the quality rating of the three best publications. And we find at the last position, 41 of 41 indicators of research transparency. At the moment, they do not play any role in hiring committees. Which is a pity because early career researchers, many of them, they want open science. And I would say it's the responsibility of senior researchers, funders, and policymakers to resolve this social dilemma for young researchers. And another pity is in the survey, they also asked not about the actual relevance of a criterion, but also the desired relevance, what should be an important criterion. And the largest discrepancy was for the indicators of research transparency. So no, the largest discrepancy was about management competencies, but in terms of research-related indicators, it should be more research transparency. So the typical researcher's narrative about data sharing, what I get, so this might be slightly exaggerated or maybe not, you can judge that. It's not the narrative of our bubble, but it's rather, well, nobody does it, why should I do it? It's a lot of work which is not rewarded at all. Research data management is boring. I have the strategic trade-off. Either I have more papers on the CV or I could, well, document some of my old stuff. Well, in order to get tenure or to get more grant money, I'd rather optimize the first one. And also, this is an often heard argument, please, no bureaucratic overregulation. We have to protect academic freedom. We do not want to be forced to do anything. So how can we go forward and try to connect these two bubbles? And how can we maybe achieve to increase the actual sharing rates? These are answers from a survey on 600 researchers. What are barriers to data sharing? And it starts with, I never learned to share data online. I just don't have the skill to do it, 54%. Only 12% say there's no suitable repository to share my data. Preparing data is too time-consuming. Sharing data is not a common practice in my field. And there's no proper recognition for sharing. If we want to achieve a cultural change, we have to address these barriers. And there recently has been a nice tweet storm by Brian Nosek, who proposed a 5-step scheme for achieving cultural change. And I really like the scheme. So the first step is implementation. We need a reliable infrastructure that makes it possible to do the behaviors. If there is no repository, I simply cannot share my data. At that stage, I will get the idealists, the enthusiasts. As soon as there's a technical possibility to do it, well, this small group of early adopters, they will do it. But we want to get a broader, we want to leave our bubble, we want to get a broader range of researchers. And the second step is called interfaces. Workflows that make it easy to do the behaviors. So it's not just possible, it should be also easy. With that step, we will get the supporters, which support the values in principle, but need the easy user-friendly tools to do the behavior. The third step would be norms. Communities define what is good scientific practice. So this relates to this barrier. Sharing data is not a common practice in my field. If we achieve to change the norms that it would be normal to share the data, we would get the substantial middle looking for guidance. Just they look, okay, what do the others do? Well, I do the same. Next step would be incentives. We could reward openness. With that step, we can get the pragmatics. They want to see, okay, I can do it, but I want to get something for it. That's the proper recognition for data sharing. And the final step would be policy, simply requiring openness. Well, the last step, this is targeted at it's called the resistant adherence to status quo. If you don't get them by norms or incentives, well, you get them by policy. And for the rest of the talk, I just want to go through the 5 steps and see what do we have and what do we need. Well, implementation, we have talked about that today. Okay, we have the EOSC, we have the V3 data registry, and so on. But implementation alone is not enough. We need interfaces. So I could throw the 500-page DDI documentation, which tells me how to document my metadata according to the Dublin Core metadata scheme. This will be to no use to nearly anybody. So we need user-friendly workflows. And I want to highlight one project, which is the DataVis. This is a website, an assistant, which guides the user step-by-step through a data management or documentation plan. It's developed by the Leibniz Institute for Psychology, which is the social sister of the ZBW. And I think that's the right way to go. There are many other initiatives. We heard about the Go Fair, the Go Train, Foster Open Air. I think training people also is at the second stage. to enable users to really use the implementations. So we need software solutions, but also supporting persons. We heard that already today, data stewards at the local level, which assist in doing the steps. Concerning the norms, how could we change the norms? Here, I also want to highlight just one initiative. It's called the PRO, the Peer Reviewers Openness Initiative. This is a website where you can sign up, and signatories of this initiative, they say, we only provide a comprehensive review in the review process of a paper if the paper provides open data and open material, or a justification why it's not possible to do so. So if there's neither openness nor a justification, we simply do not review the paper. I think around 500 researchers already signed this initiative, and it already has led some journals to change their policies because they encountered these pro reviewers, and it was a bit annoying because they had to look for another reviewer, and they decided to change the policies and ask for the open data right away. So more and more journals change from an opt-in to an opt-out policy. And of course, changing the norms is a slow process, which is also done by education. So if we educate our students and say, this is how science is done, this is the right way of good scientific practice and integrity, then we hope that the next generation will have internalized these norms. Assume that we have established the norms, we can install incentives. And what is the simplest and easiest incentive that we can make? Well, we can give people a badge. This costs us nothing. And here's the open data badge. And now you can ask, well, does that really help? So are we really driven by badges? There's a study. The journal Psychological Science is one of our top journals in our field. They implemented this open data badge here at the red line. And here's the prevalence of open data. It's basically around 3 or 5% across the years. These are comparable journals, the gray ones. And just by introducing the badge, the open data rate rose from virtually 0 to 38% in 1.5 years. So it's a very simple implementation, which really seems to work. So as you can see, the extra costs for the journal are very few. You just have to add the badges to the workflow. Extra costs for the researchers, well, they have to provide the data, okay. But except that, it's very easy and cheap. What could funders do? They could add public data sets as a section to the CV template. So we already ask, for example, at the DFG, for up to 10 of the most important publications. We could highlight the importance of public data sets by adding a mandatory section where you can list up to 5 of your most important public data sets and why they are important. Well, some applicants will have 0 items on this section of the CV, others will have more items. Also here, the costs are really basically 0. It's adding 1 sentence to the guidelines and not more. Hiring committees could make open science a desirable or essential job characteristic. In 2015, when the replication crisis was on its peak in psychology, the LMU in Munich announced a professorship position for social psychology, and we added a paragraph to the job description, which you cannot really read. So the paragraph says, our department values open science, which includes open data, open material, and pre-registrations. And we ask applicants to write a paragraph about how they pursued these goals in the past and how they plan to pursue it in the future. And this really made a difference in this hiring committee. And since that, we added the paragraph to all professorship descriptions. Since then, I think it have been 5. And other universities, here's the University of Cologne, for example, are picking this up and using the same paragraph. And in a very recent move, the Charité Berlin, thanks to the work by Ulrich Dirnagel and the Quest Center, they also require an open science statement for all professorship positions. So that's another very easily implementable idea. In hiring committees, we could require an annotated CV with limited items, so you are only allowed to list 10 of your best publications. And for example, you could list the authors and the titles without the journal name, because we know that the journal impact factor is an unreliable and invalid indicator of quality. If anything, it's an indicator for unreliable science. So we could just leave out the journal. Instead, add paper-level citation metrics. We could add basic information for judging the evidential value of the study. So in psychology, this would be, for example, the sample size and the p-value of each study. Then we could add open science indicators. Do we have open data for that study? Was it pre-registered or not? And so on. If you have open data, please provide the URL where you can find it or the DOI. And we could also list the applicant's contributions. So what is my contribution to that paper? And I think evaluating such a CV or publication list would give us much more information about the quality. Well, still, it's a superficial indicator system, but it would be much more interesting to read that instead of the classical publication list. Again, no extra costs for the committees and only few extra costs for the applicants. Now, one stage is left. In the survey, they also ask, how likely are you to share your research data if? So what do you think? What should happen? What is the top item that must happen before most of them share their data? Well, your research funder requires you to share. If that is the case, 94% of participants would share their data. So that is the last level policy. And many funders shifted their policies in the last years. Here's some examples. The Wellcome Trust maybe is one of the most progressive. They say, as a minimum, the data underpinning research papers should be made available to other researchers at the time of publication. And they also check at the end, in the final report of the grant, whether researchers have managed and shared their outputs in the grant evaluation process. So they do not only have an input control during the grant proposal process, but also an output control at the end. So another easy step, when we write the final reports for our grants, funders could require a transparency and openness statement, which simply asks, are the relevant data from the funded project accessible in an open repository? Yes, no. If yes, please provide the DOI. If not, please provide a short justification. No costs, but potentially a huge impact. So this is just collecting all the ideas that I have shown to you. And here I copied from Wolfram Horstmann, he already said, bridging the last mile. And I agree that this is the crucial point. So my fear is if we miss the last mile and if the incentive system stays as it is, all these high-level policy changes will have little impact on the actual behavior of researchers. So this is my last slide. This is a question I ask myself, and I really have no answer, and maybe we can discuss that. What is the better strategy? Should we aim for a fast adoption, or should we aim for a high quality from the beginning on? In psychology, at the moment, we implicitly do the fast adoption approach. So this was not a conscious decision, it just happened. So we have low hurdles. Most of us use the Open Science Framework, which is like a Dropbox system. You can upload anything. So you can say, here's my data, and you upload a cat image. Very low hurdles, but we could reward the small steps. So sharing something, even if it's badly documented and so on, might be better than sharing nothing. We can hope that researchers learn by doing. So with increasing practice, it gets better. But we have to accept that initially we will have very low quality of the shared data. So for a research project, I tried to reproduce the analysis of some dozens of projects on the Open Science Framework, and it was really a pain in the ass. It was nearly not possible to reproduce what they did. So these data are not fair. They are not reusable at all, most of them. And it also has the risk of open washing. So people could pretend openness just by uploading some chunk file, which looks like data. Nobody really verifies it. And you maybe even get the open data badge because the reviewers do not really check the quality of the data. And so we have no input control here. So that's the risk of the fast adoption approach. On the other hand, we could aim for high quality from the beginning on. This would be a very high hurdle. So if all data sets in my discipline in psychology must be fair before they are uploaded somewhere, I think we would lose at least 80 to 90% of all researchers. Most wouldn't do it then. But this, what is open, is instantly reusable and of high quality. So I have no idea what is better. Maybe we can aim for a mixture of both. I'm not sure, but yeah, we could discuss that. And yeah, I'm finished. Thank you very much.